Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. So, whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay ahead with some of the stories that really count. And coming up on the program, the impact of extreme weather on the South African economy, a top global risk analyst on South Africa's position in a volatile world. Faces and phases of resilience, a new book on how we bounce back from adversity, and key strategies for building successful brands in an economically constrained environment. It's Friday, the 2nd of May. Now, I don't need to tell you that South Africa is increasingly facing the brunt of climate change, with extreme weather events like floods and droughts becoming more frequent and severe. And obviously, these events have profound implications, not just environmentally, but economically. They would affect industry, infrastructure, and even our livelihoods. And I want to put some of that under the microscope. Joining us is Dr. Nomhle Ngwenya, board member of the National Advisory Council on Innovation, and an expert in climate risk and ESG. Dr. Ngwenya, thank you very much for talking to us. You've highlighted the economic strain of climate-induced events. How do you assess South Africa's current economic resilience to repetitive weather shocks?
Thank you for this. I think this is such a very timely and important, you know, conversation, because climate change is exacerbating already some of the, you know, economic challenges that we have. For example, we already have a chronic infrastructure challenge with aging infrastructure and lack of regular maintenance. And climate change is exacerbating some of these, you know, challenges, where whenever an extreme weather event happens, for example, with, you know, floods, you know, infrastructure is always impacted, where we have an issue with stormwater to drainage systems, you know, or even just our pothole crisis being exacerbated. And so with, you know, climate change, you know, increasing with intensity and frequency, this will definitely have strong ripple effects across the economy.
And I'd suggest to you that the climate risks are probably not integrated adequately enough into macroeconomic planning and policy. There is a disconnect, surely, between the environmental realities that you've just outlined and broader economic planning.
Agreed. And we see this, how even when, you know, a weather event happens, we see that there's a lack of sort of, you know, institutional coordination amongst different departments. There seems to always be a reliance on COCTA, but climate change, you know, easily spills into, you know, Department of Health, Department of Transport, etc. So on a government level, there's a lack of integration. But also, you know, we are not integrating extreme weather events into things like, you know, national statistics and economic modeling, which is very important. We really need to have an understanding of how does climate change or extreme weather events have an impact on, you know, economic modeling and also on our GDP as well.
Why do you think we're not doing that? Do we just have our heads in the sand?
So one, I think, you know, there's a lack of, you know, collaboration. Just in terms of, you know, the private sector and you know, government. And the reason why I mentioned the private sector is because if you look at, you know, South African Reserve Bank and the Prudential Authority, they have been working very closely with businesses on how to integrate climate-related risks into their balance sheet. So there's a keen interest on how private sector can really, you know, adapt and mitigate according, you know, to climate change. So there's a lack of, you know, collaboration that I think they're great insights that both government and private sector can learn from. But two, I think there's also lack of skills. You know, if we look at just 10, 20 years ago, you know, integrating climate-related risks and, you know, integrating them with, you know, financial knowledge, I think that has been something that is very new. So there's a gap in knowledge for that. And this is why things like, you know, global initiatives like the Network for Greening the Financial Systems, you know, and other international institutions become very important, where we can have lessons learned from both developed and developing countries on how to mitigate and adapt to extreme weather events.
Do you think there is a reluctance from the private sector to become more involved in this process? Or is it simply government turning around and saying we can do this on our own?
So I think it's many factors, and the first part is really just in terms of investments. When we speak around, you know, investments, I think there's a huge reliance on private sector to come and, you know, pitch in and also invest in things like early warning monitoring systems. But yet we also need to, you know, tap into fiscal policy and budgeting. For example, COCTA has over, you know, 600 million towards a billion, you know, factored into extreme weather events. So we really need to tap into, you know, contingency funds. What does government have and what does private sector have? And how can we meet the two halfway? But also, we need to ensure that the policy foundation in our country is well adapted. As I've mentioned, we have fantastic policies, but it's a mere gist of implementation. And this speaks to what I mentioned earlier on around the institutional collaboration that is missing. So it really is a combination of two.
Dr. Ngwenya, in your role as a member of the National Advisory Council on Innovation, do you think that technological innovation is being invested in sufficiently enough in terms of mitigating the climate risks that you've outlined?
So if we look at some of the key, you know, policies, for example, the decadal plan, and looking just into what, you know, Minister Nzimande has really been pushing in terms of, you know, artificial technology, and this cuts across into, you know, the early warning investments that we really need. So there really is, you know, greater awareness and a lot of work that is being done to ensure that, you know, not only do we just invest in early warning systems, but also this links into our greater science, you know, and decadal plans that we have for the country.
It's also important, I imagine, for local communities to be better prepared and involved in resilience building against these climate-induced disasters. The reality, though, is that there are so many other competing priorities.
Agreed. So if we look, I mean, just on that, we have, you know, so many socioeconomic challenges. We've got high unemployment rates. We've got, you know, poverty, you know, health challenges, etc. But this is where things like Indigenous knowledge becomes very, very critical and important, where we ensure that communities are also empowered and communities can play a role, you know, in, you know, climate adaptation and mitigation projects.
So a final question then, against the backdrop of everything that you've outlined, how much time do we have?
Very minimal. Extreme weather events are increasing in intensity and frequency. We're having a very volatile climate crisis. If we just even take a look at, you know, the Durban floods that happened in April 2022, how our GDP contracted by 0.7%, and how we have key sectors like agriculture, which need particular climate conditions, but with climate change becoming so unpredictable, you know, this will definitely have a direct impact and drive up, you know, agricultural, you know, prices. So just in terms of time, we don't have a lot of time left, but, you know, we do have massive opportunities in terms of investments, partnership and collaboration to ensure that we effectively, you know, adapt and mitigate against these extreme weather events.
Well, the warning has been sounded. Dr. Nomhle Ngwenya, thank you very much indeed. Board member of the National Advisory Council on Innovation, also an expert in climate risk and ESG. Thank you so much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, it's a year of high geopolitical stakes, and particularly for the global south and for South Africa. And the spotlight, I would contend, is turning inward and outward at the same time. Internationally, of course, South Africa is navigating its identity between BRICS and the West, with critical implications for trade, for energy security, as well as diplomatic alignment. I'm in conversation now with Dr. Elizabeth Stevens, Director at Geopolitical Risk Advisory, and she's an expert on that intersection of political instability and business strategy. Elizabeth, thank you very much for talking to me today. And maybe before we focus on the global south and South Africa, maybe broadly, where in the world do you see political risk accelerating the most quickly right now, and why?
The fastest acceleration of geopolitical risk is between the United States and China, as are the world's largest economies and have the largest militaries. If we take out Russia's nuclear arsenal, what happens between those superpowers impacts every country and every individual in the world, and tensions are at an all-time high between those governments at present.
So that also means that the risk calculus, I imagine, is changing for countries in the global south.
It is. For a number of years now, the US and China have been trying to draw countries in the global south into their orbit. And obviously, the global south covers a broad swathe of the world with, and comprises of very different countries with very different interests. But the US is the largest economy in the world, $31 trillion. China is second at 19.5 trillion, but is the world's largest exporter. So they both have vital trade relations with countries in the global south that are vital to them and to those smaller countries as well. So right now, with America and its tariffs, okay, they've been paused on many countries, but they're impacting trade flows. And I think a real challenge for the global south at present is how do they navigate that disruption, work effectively with China, and also ensure that Chinese manufactured products don't swamp their markets. Now the US is effectively closed to many Chinese exports.
So, as far as developing economies are concerned, and given the paradigm that you've just outlined to me, can economies, again, like South Africa's, afford not to pick a side?
Oh, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? In my view, countries will be forced into choosing sides, particularly in the tech space. I mean, the narrative around technology and the divide between China and the US has been established for several years now. When Trump was first in office, he pressurized European countries and the UK not to use Huawei technology in 5G. With that conversation goes on with the Saudi Arabia and the UAE now. America is saying to them, use our tech, don't use China's tech. And I see that conversation being rolled out around the global south, particularly with key economic and military partners. So I definitely think in the tech space, countries will be forced to take sides.
So, as far as companies operating in that space are concerned, do they need a new playbook for navigating this politically contested environment? How do they need to change their operating strategy, I wonder?
Well, we've seen many of the largest companies in the world now are not providing forward earnings data to the markets. Many of the CEOs of those companies, they're not quite saying as bluntly as this, but the point is, we have no idea what our sales and revenue will be over the next 6 months because we have no idea what's going to happen with US tariffs. We have never seen this situation before. The level of uncertainty is phenomenal. And we see that in the destruction to the market cap of the world's leading companies. So yes, risk managers, CEOs, CFOs, they need a new risk strategy. Partly that's around scenario planning. Let's think for the unthinkable and plan for it. But also let's look at new supply options and let's look at new markets and let's look at how we can trade with neighboring countries, perhaps rather than looking as far afield as the US. There are domestic markets. So, within the global south, most countries have a growing and thriving middle class. And as people move into the middle class and upper middle class, they have much larger disposable incomes.
And the frightening thing about all of this, I imagine, is thinking the unthinkable is very necessary these days because often that unthinkable, as we have seen in the past 100 days or so, has come to pass.
It has. And in the run-up to the US election last year, I was discussing with clients, who would win the election? And my company and I, we thought Trump would win and we thought he would take the swing states, which many clients, particularly European clients, that idea was anathema to them. So they couldn't comprehend that. And then the second part of our advice was Trump this time, he's surrounded by true believers. He will do what he said he is going to do, and that is big tariffs. I think the scale of them is unprecedented, but he said he was going to do this. And what's unusual is he is a democratically elected leader who is actually doing what he said he would do, which is highly unusual. And he doesn't appear to be concerned about re-election at present. Because, I mean, his popularity has dropped, but he's still polling at 47%, which is good for a democratic leader at present. And I think what he's doing this time, he's thinking, in the past, Wall Street disrespected me. I'm now going to play to my base, and my base of voters have lost out from globalization. Globalization has helped the top 10%, the top 1%, and phenomenally, the top 0.1%. But the other 90% who voted for me have lost out. We've lost manufacturing jobs. My focus is on them. I don't think his tariffs are going to work out in the way he anticipates, and that we're going to see manufacturing return to the US on a large scale. But I think that's the part of his base is appealing to now. And he's paying less attention to Wall Street.
And Dr. Stevens, just a final one then. For those of us sitting on the tip of Africa and from a global perspective, where does this country, do you think, sit in this new geopolitical matrix, given our increasing tensions or the increasing tensions between Pretoria and Washington?
Yes, South Africa does have the challenge of the diplomatic tensions as well as economic challenges. Given the views of the Trump administration around certain geopolitical issues and conflicts, it's going to be very difficult for Pretoria to negotiate a change in tariffs while holding diametrically opposed views to the US on, you know, questions such as Israel. So that is a real challenge. I don't see an easy way out. But Trump and his advisors do actually understand that certain elements of trade are vital to the US as well. That's coming to the fore. And I would say that's what Pretoria needs to play on.
Dr. Elizabeth Stevens, Director, Geopolitical Risk Advisory, thank you very much for talking to me today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, as South Africa grapples with myriad problems, what comes to mind? Power cuts, rising anger, deepening inequality in 2025. The idea of resilience is everywhere. But what does it really mean? Professor Tiniko Maluleke is the Vice Chancellor of the Tshwane University of Technology and takes this question head on in a new collection of essays called Faces and Phases of Resilience. It's available at all good bookstores. And these essays explore whether personal strength can still matter in a country under pressure. Professor, a very warm welcome to you. You argue in the book that resilience is personal. But in a failing country in many respects like South Africa, do you think that personal resilience is enough to counter the collapse that so many of us experience on a day-to-day basis?
Perhaps not immediately, Jeremy. Personal resilience will not immediately solve our infrastructure or education problems, which are a myriad. It will not, but it has always been the secret factor in enabling a people to emerge out of very difficult situations, like we emerged out of apartheid. It is personal, it is communal, and there is a sense in which it is also environmental. That's why my book refers to rivers and mountains quite a bit. Because they are part and parcel of what helps us become resilient. So it doesn't always produce quick results, but it is always there. And we just need to tap on it and to reconnect with it.
Professor, some people might turn around and say, though, that they are tired of being resilient, that this term is often used as an excuse for citizens to tolerate bad governance. I wonder if there's not a danger that the essays in the book reinforce endurance over activism.
It's not the intention. The essays in the book present a nuanced and multifaceted notion or notions of resilience. So resilience is not always being an imbokodo, where you are, as we say about women, is imbokodo, they are rocks. You touch a woman, you touch a rock. Sometimes resilience is about becoming like a willow. The wind blows and you bend in order to survive. So resilience is not only about endurance. So it's not either political activism or resilience. I mean, think of Sam Zimba, the guy who took a photo, the famous photo of June 76. I write about him. All he was doing a job and taking a photo of what he sensed. was a very crucial moment in the history of the country. And then the photo went on to do more things than he even ever dreamt of.
Professor, what I found fascinating in the book is your ability to weave humor in occasion or on occasion into the suffering of South Africans. I wondered, though, as I read this, whether you think maybe we joke a little too much about our pain sometimes instead of in confronting it head on.
Yes. Actually, I do think that humor is a deep source of resilience. Well, it can be abused, like everything. But I do think, I mean, when I think of the village where I grew up in and how humor was used to ward off the cultural erosion and the economic erosion that was coming both from the colonialists and the Boers over on the other side of the river, if you like, and the missionaries who were resident. And without humor, the community might have simply fallen apart. You know, so it is, I mean, think of Desmond Tutu and how he used humor to make sense of South Africa at a very difficult time. I mean, he, of all people, not to use humor because he was in the thick of things, you know, stopping people from being necklaced. And yet, again and again, he returned to humor to find sustenance.
Professor, it's very evident in the book that you have survived and even thrived in tough institutions and tough situations. But bringing it back to 2025 for young South Africans, many of whom are facing mass unemployment, they're dealing with corruption on a daily basis. Right now, in the current idiom, what realistic form do you think resilience can take?
It's a difficult question, but I do think that we will be a very sad country if we were to give in and give up completely, especially to the young people, to give in to the ethics of corruption, for young people to give up on making something useful of themselves, give up on acquiring the skills they need, and give up on dreaming. Because it's all, I mean, if I tell the story of Pamela Dube, the VC of Central University of Technology, here is a girl, if she will pardon me, in inverted commas, from Gwamakuta in Amanzimtoti. She has nothing but a big dream. Here is a boy from Mapacha King in Zibidiela, Musa Mushabela, the current vice chancellor of CUT. What does he have? He has a big dream to become a doctor one day, perpetrated on the side by his own grandmother, to dream that big. So I think we should continue to dream big. We deserve a better country than the one we have. We deserve that country that Mandela promised us. We deserve that country that is reflected in the National Development Plan. We deserve it, and we must never allow anyone to tell us to accept something less.
And at the end of the book, do you believe, is the conclusion that you've reached that South Africa can build on the optimism that you've just articulated and that we can reinvent ourselves? Or do you still have concern that we are now just managing a long decline?
Look, I still believe that we can emerge. So you will see that one of the things I return to again and again in my book, through the various narratives that I weave together there, is to go back to the deep sources of resilience, to look at resilience, the resilience behind the resilience. In other words, when I talk about Mandela, I don't talk about him just walking out of prison, raising his fist. I also talk about the importance of his father and mother and how painful it was for him not to be at his mother's funeral and how that made him, in a sense, the kind of leader that he was. So we must not allow the surface things only to influence our sense of hope and our sense of resilience. We must go behind. And I think there's lots and lots of stories of South Africans who are winning this war, perhaps at a personal level, perhaps at a smaller scale, in a village, in a township. Those are the stories that we should unearth in order to realize that it's not all doom and gloom.
If you are a concerned and critical South African, I strongly recommend that you get hold of the book. It's called Faces and Phases of Resilience. The author is Professor Tinyiku Maluleki, and the publisher is Tracy McDonald Publishers. Professor, thank you very much indeed.
Top stories to keep your eyes and ears on.
Now, 2025, I think, is shaping up to be a really defining year for brand leadership. And winning names are not just going to sell products. It's all about driving purpose. It's about embracing technology and connecting with consumers on a much deeper, more human level. So from purpose-led positioning to AI-driven personalization and influencer storytelling to full-funnel marketing, brands these days are asked to do a whole lot more, but perhaps more tellingly, they've got to prove it as well. And there's no doubt that competition is stiffening and consumer expectations are rising. So the question is, what kind of strategy is going to separate the leaders from the rest? And I want to examine that now with some of the year's big brand trends so far and what they mean for marketers and business leaders alike. And I'm in conversation with Andisa Ntubani, who is Managing Executive Brand Marketing and Brand and Sponsorship at Vodacom. Andisa, a very warm welcome. And let's start here, maybe. This whole thing about purpose when it comes to building a brand, is it still a differentiator or is everyone starting to claim it?
Well, good afternoon, Jeremy and the listeners. I really think it's a differentiator. I think what you do have is a lot of commoditization, specifically in terms of products and services and solutions. And purpose can be a big part of the differentiator in terms of the why a brand exists. And when people can see the causal connection between what your brand is doing and how it's showing up and how it's helping to solve problems, I think that's a massive, massive source of competitive advantage. And I think having seen some work from around the world, I think how it's showing up is actually the more interesting part, which is leadership brands are taking leadership positions on some of the biggest issues that are facing the world. And I think from a consumer point of view, consumers are looking at brands and looking to businesses to help address some of these economic, social, and environmental issues that the world is going through. And I think that when people have and can see a brand doing that, it does help in terms of preference. And so what I saw was brands taking a leadership position on issues like climate change. And one of the brands that really shone through for me in B2B, which I judged at Cannes last year, was DP World. And basically what DP World did is they understood that the global temperature for transporting food around the world is at minus 18 degrees. And they simply asked one fundamental question. Why does it need to be minus 18? And they basically did research. They worked with universities, and they came to the conclusion that you can actually transport food with no impact at minus 15, 3 degrees warmer. And basically, based on the research, they started a movement which was launched at COP at the COP conference, and which was called the Move to Minus 15. And basically, the net impact of that campaign and the net impact of it in terms of the environmental impact, in terms of climate change, and they basically got to the answer that said it was the equivalent of taking 3.5 million cars off the road every year. They got their competitors in terms of other shipping companies on board with this movement who signed up. 70% of the industry signed up to the Move to Minus 15. And that's had a massive impact. Mm. We're starting to have a massive impact on climate change. So the point I'm making is that's how brands are showing up to really help solve and address the largest issues that the world is facing globally, but also from a continental point of view, there's some brands doing some amazing things to help solve and address the issues that the continent is facing. And I think that's how it's showing up.
So, Andisa, you make the point then, as far as brands taking a stand is concerned. I get that. I understand it. But you've also got to have some thought given to and maybe even a risk mitigation strategy, because these kind of things can also backfire as well. You cannot go into something like this with one hand tied behind your back.
Absolutely. And this is why it's so important that this is leader-led. And as an organization, you've got to talk a lot about your house views. What are your house views on some of the key issues that are facing your market, your country, your continent? And are you going to have a point of view on all of those things, or are you going to have specific points of view on the things that are most pertinent, aligned to your industry, but more importantly, aligned to your brand and your brand persona? Because people have also got to be able to see the causal connection between, for example, if you talk about telecommunications, about digital inclusion, about financial inclusion, those things make sense in terms of the causal connection between what the business does and what the brand stands for with what they're trying to do. So that part is also an important piece of the puzzle. And therefore, it's important that there are internal conversations about how you will respond externally, but you've also been able to back it up with real information and data around the importance of taking a stand on specific issues. Because as you say, these things can backfire.
So let me pivot now from purpose to artificial intelligence. It is everywhere. It's ubiquitous. So I guess the challenge is for marketers to avoid it becoming a gimmick and for the concept to drive real value. Where are brands moving in that direction?
I think it's in the first instance, a very important and strategic question. And so, for example, one of the big dilemmas is most brands will tell you about the importance of humanizing the brand. And in the context of humanizing the brand, what's the role of AI? It almost feels like a juxtaposition between the two. So there's some strategic questions around what will you do with AI? How will you use it? And how will you integrate it to enhance what you're trying to do from a brand perspective? So it's an enabler versus we've got to keep the main thing. And AI is just an enabler of the main thing is the first thing I'd say. The second thing that I'll say is that there's absolutely no doubt about the role of AI and automation in helping to reduce and drive efficiencies from a marketing operational point of view. There's been lots of conversations about, you know, how marketing, you know, we always sit in these interesting conundrums where people say to us, yeah, only half of marketing works. We don't know which half. Mm. And I think now with AI, with automation, with data, we can really drive real meaningful marketing attribution that can talk about the correlation between activities and outcomes. But even more importantly, we can be drive a lot more precision marketing using data, analytics, and also weaving in things like behavioral science and behavioral linguistics to help us drive shifts and drive people lower down the funnel. All using technology.
I think
these large language models can also help us, last point, in helping us to connect a lot more deeply across languages, across different cultures, and really help us to be able to drive some of the big impact of the activities that we're doing from a brand perspective.
And Andisa, I think the key word in that argument is enabler, because it's critical that you've got to blend in the human experience, the human feeling, human creativity with the efficiency that artificial intelligence brings in brand building. And often people just abrogate to AI without considering the former.
Absolutely. There's been massive debates. You would have seen some of the commentary in the debates and the jury's still out when Coca-Cola produced the first ever 100% AI commercial. And for a brand that is basically built and founded upon human connectedness and happiness and all of those things, it's quite an interesting one in terms of a debate. Mm-hmm. And that's why for me, it's not a start and end point. It absolutely is an enabler. And so how you've got to think about it is, how will it enable and enhance and accelerate and deepen resonance with my brand versus us leading with it as the thing? Because we've got to keep the main thing, as I said. And the brand essence is important to make sure that we keep the essence of the brand the same, but be able to evolve as technology and some of these new generation technologies evolve. And how is it helping us to deepen, as I say, our customer understanding and the way we connect better with consumers?
Lots of food for thought there, and I am going to leave it with my thanks. Andisa Ntsubane, thank you indeed, Managing Executive Brand Marketing and Brand and Sponsorship at Vodacom. And that's MoneyWeb at Midday for today. We are live at noon weekdays, then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.